Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's subject is biofilms. Biofilms are colonies of bacteria that hide within structures that are sometimes hard to reach by the body's immune system, by antibiotics, by even natural botanicals. And our guest is Dr. Stephen Olmsted. He's chief science officer of a great company called Claire Labs, which is a division of ProThera. They specialize in gastrointestinal therapies, probiotics, and things like that. But in the process of trying to figure out how to normalize gut function and get rid of bad bugs and replace them with good bugs, Dr. Olmsted has investigated the biofilm and the role that biofilms played. We talk about that in part one of today's podcast. I recommend that you listen to that before you listen to this part two. So let's talk about some practical implications of this. What are some of the products that have been developed to attack biofilms? What do they consist of, and how do they work?
Okay, well, the product for gastrointestinal biofilm is called Interphase. And so
and that's spelled with an I-N-T-E-R-F-A-S-E?
F-A-S-E.
Right. So not P-H, but F-A-S-E. Okay.
Correct. And so this is a combination of carbohydrates, so enzymes that break up carbohydrates like cellulase and beta-glucanase, some other enzymes like that, and then proteases, so enzymes that can chew up proteins.
Like, so that's a little bit like the proteolytic enzyme, like Wobenzyme. Those are products that contain that, right? Vasozyme, Wobenzyme, but they don't contain the carbohydratases. They just contain the proteases, the breakdown proteins, and they're sometimes helpful against inflammation, but they may be missing a component.
They could definitely be helpful. I mean, most of the proteolytic enzymes that have been used systemically have been used, as you say, for anti-inflammatory. They're anti-inflammatory properties. And the one that's in the interphase is Serratia peptidase, a proteolytic enzyme from Serratia myrcens. And so this turns out, not only is this a great anti-inflammatory and it's well absorbed after an oral dose, but it has really significant anti-biofilm effects, really breaks down biofilm. Mm-hmm. So that, when combined with carbohydrates, it's a very effective, formula.
Okay.
And then the interphase is available both with the enzymes by themselves and in a preparation called Interphase Plus with disodium EDTA.
Okay, so you mentioned in part one, and you come to us. You have been a very authoritative person describing the mode of action of chelation therapy, which involves the self same EDTA administered intravenously. So you're a real expert on the chemistry and the physiology, you know, what it does, and it helps to pull out heavy metals. But you've discovered that EDTA also has an action against these biofilms.
That's correct, and so. Back in 2001, I got involved with a company that was looking to develop tetrasodium EDTA as a vascular catheter lock flush, so a solution that you put in a catheter, a vascular catheter, to keep it from clotting off. And those can get infected. That's always a biofilm infection. It turned out that EDTA is extremely effective at preventing the biofilm from being established and breaking up biofilm that's there. And it does that because it chelates calcium, and calcium turns out to be an important cross-linking metal within biofilm. So if you take it out of the matrix, the matrix starts to fall apart.
Yeah, so you deny it one of its building blocks.
Right.
Very cool. So what are some of the applications of these products? So, for example, and I'm personally interested in these products. That one of the reasons I'm talking to you, and I may introduce the use of some of these products with some of my more challenging patients. But say you see a typical patient who you've diagnosed candida. The patient may be a female who suffers from chronic vaginitis, has lethargy, fatigue, gastrointestinal bloating, terrible sweet cravings, skin itching, nasal congestion. You know, they're just lighting up with all kinds of signs and symptoms that suggest candida. That's a patient where I would say, okay, go on a low-carb diet, all right? And I think that's generally acknowledged. Don't eat yeast-derived foods or fermented foods. Take a probiotic, certainly, okay. And, you know, Claire has a wide assortment of great probiotics, and other companies make, you know, very very useful probiotics. Maybe take a botanical, or perhaps take an antifungal medication. Take nystatin, take diflucan, take olive leaf extract, take berberine, take any number of substances that have an inhibitory effect against yeast. So where in that sequence does the biofilm therapy come in? Is this, do you do this first as a prelude to your antifungal therapy, or where does that enter in?
So this has been the approach that I've been suggesting for 5 years now. It seems to work. Is that at the same time that you're taking your antifungals, and it doesn't matter whether it's their prescription antifungals or whether these are natural antifungals, you also take the antibiofilm enzymes, and you take these on an empty stomach.
So it helps them penetrate better. In effect, it's like hamburger helper for the antifungals.
Exactly. So while they're in the biofilm, they're protected. Their metabolic rate is often low. Sometimes the antimicrobial doesn't even penetrate the biofilm. Sometimes it penetrates but is absorbed to the polysaccharides, and so obviously can't do anything. So the idea is to disrupt that, to get the organisms moving, metabolizing again. It's sort of like if you go up to a red ant pile and kick it, you'll pretty soon find that the ants go into hyper mode.
Right.
And that's what happens with the biofilm. And so that.
But that's when you can stomp on the ants.
That's right. And if you don't do something about the ants, they'll just make the ant pile again. And that's just what happens. So you have to combine both the antibiofilm enzymes and the antimicrobials or antifungals. And then at a different time of day, you take the probiotics, and then also I think prebiotics are useful. And prebiotics are essentially macromolecules, big molecules like polysaccharides, but they don't have to be polysaccharides, that our bodies can't break down but pass into the gut, where healthful populations of bacteria are able to metabolize, ferment those, and it increases the numbers and activities of healthful populations. So
things like inulin and fructose oligosaccharides, or FOS, these are among them, right?
Exactly, or galacto-oligosaccharides, or beta-glucans, or larch arabinogalactans. So there are a number of...
Larch bark extract, things like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. So there are a number of different good prebiotics out there. And an advantage of them is they increase populations of organisms that are not available to us as probiotics, but are very helpful for us to have in our colon. So that's basically the protocol. My bias is to treat for 3 months, and that's something that I learned from someone you know, Dr. Elmer Cranton, who is retired now, but had decades of experience treating these patients, and found that a longer course of therapy was going to be more successful than a shorter course.
So let's see where the rubber meets the road on this concept, because you actually write this nice article that you've written on this subject, which lists some of the conditions where this might be applicable. One, and I was surprised by this, Barrett's esophagus. This is a precancerous condition of the esophagus. And you write that there is a biofilm aspect to that. Could you explain that?
That's correct. So there's an alteration in the microbial populations. Normally, the microbial populations of the distal of the esophagus, where it goes into the stomach, and even the duodenum for that matter, they should have very low numbers of bacteria. But when you have chronic reflux, when you have acid going up into the esophagus long term over years, you get changes in the histology of the esophagus, and you also get the development of a different community of organisms that actually is making precancerous substances, and that's why people with Barrett's esophagus have a high risk of esophageal carcinoma.
So you want to clear that out with a period of therapy.
Clear that out, right?
Okay,
right.
Okay, so moving right. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to. I just wouldn't want anybody to think that the enzymes alone are going to be the solution.
Right.
They have to be combined with other things to.
And I will tell you that there are natural substances that protect the esophagus that have an anti-cancer effect, and I'm very happy with the results we're getting. Often in
Great.
Patients with Barrett's, they're often told that they're very, very likely to get esophageal cancer, and often with the natural therapy, we can actually normalize their esophageal epithelium, the tissue that lines the esophagus. It's quite remarkable. All right, so moving right along through the gastrointestinal tract as we take our fantastic voyage downward, we next get to the stomach, which is afflicted with another bug called Helicobacter pylori, or H. pylori.
Right.
And you write that
right.
H. pylori also may be protected in biofilms, and that's actually one of the reasons it's very perplexing in medicine. They have these really powerful drugs that are supposed to knock out H. pylori, and they initially worked, they were fairly successful, but now there's a tremendous amount of resistance to H. pylori. The powerful drugs don't seem to work anymore, so is this a potential breakthrough against H. pylori?
I think it is a potential breakthrough against H. pylori. There's no test for pathogenic biofilm, but a clinician's suspicion should be increased when you're dealing with infections that have a high relapse rate or are refractory to therapy, and H. pylori falls into that group. There's a high relapse rate, and the primary success is not great. It depends on what series you read, but it could be anywhere from 60% to 85% successful. So you got a lot of treatment failures, and it turns out that H. pylori lives in biofilm. And there's a great study that was done by a surgical group. They were doing endoscopies in people. And urease is a test.
It's a breath test.
It's a breath test that's used. It's basically to look for an enzyme that breaks down urea, like you have in urine, urea. And people that are positive for this have a high colonization burden of H. pylori. And so what they found when they did endoscopies is that people who were urease positive, that over 90%, 97% of their stomach mucosa, the lining of their stomach, was covered by H. pylori biofilm.
Oh, wow.
Huge.
Wow.
And so as their controls, they had patients who were urease negative and were undergoing endoscopy for some other reason. And they did find H. pylori in these patients, but really it only involved like less than 2% of their gastric mucosa. And of course, there's one whole school of thought that thinks that H. pylori is in fact a normal commensal
in the stomach. We don't necessarily want to eradicate it just merely because
exactly.
It's there. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think that's part of what's going on there. And mm-hmm. so we actually in the laboratory we developed a model of H. pylori biofilm. And have some really pretty scanning electron micrographs to show. But what we found was that this interphase enzyme preparation could completely eradicate H. pylori biofilm in the laboratory. And then when you combined it with standard antibiotics like amoxicillin or clarithromycin that are used to treat H. pylori, what it was able to do, the combination of the interphase and antibiotic, it allowed the antibiotic to be effective at really, really small concentration. So you could get down to a concentration of 0.01 micrograms per mil of tetracycline, really low concentration, and you could still get over log for killing of the H. pylori.
Well, that's great.
So for folks, you know, log four is basically 10,000. You know, that's 10,000 times increase in killing ability of the tetracycline. So it will make the medical therapy more effective.
So moving right along down the gastrointestinal tract as we continue our journey, inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's. You write that biofilms may be implicated there.
Well, we know that or at least we think we know that part of the pathophysiology of inflammatory bowel disease is an abnormal immune reaction to organisms that should normally be tolerated. There's some really interesting work done in Poland, which shows that people with inflammatory bowel disease have increased colonization burden with Candida. And so if you're able to disrupt the Candida biofilm, you will make the patients more likely to respond to medical therapy.
In fact, one of the tests for Crohn's disease specifically, it's an anti-Saccharomyces antibodies. It's anti-yeast antibodies that are elevated, suggesting,
exactly.
You know, I mean, it suggests to everybody but the gastroenterologist that there may be yeast connection to inflammatory bowel disease.
What's really interesting is that increase in the antibody titer to Saccharomyces cerevisiae may, in fact, be indicative not so much of a primary immune response to the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, but rather cross-reactivity to Candida albicans,
right,
cell wall antigens.
And moving even further down, one problem that is really, you know, hard to treat, chronic bladder infections. Bladder infections just recur, they recur, and, you know, once they take hold, some women and some men require frequent doses of antibiotics, and they never seem to shake the presence of the bacteria within their bladders completely, and the infections are always lurking, and the slightest provocation and the infection comes back. Is that a biofilm phenomenon?
That's going to be a biofilm phenomenon. It's in a high percentage of cases, but for biofilms that are outside of the gut, what I generally recommend is high dose serratia peptidase. So that's well absorbed. It's going to get into the body. It's going to go to the bladder. It's going to go to.
That's not the interphase product or the interphase plus.
No,
that's a separate product.
No, separate product.
And it's called serratia peptidase.
Serratia peptidase.
Okay, and that's available through Clear Labs, correct?
It is.
And moving right along. And this is a problem which bedevils many men and their urologists, chronic prostatitis. I mean, it's thought to be an infection, but boy, it does not respond very well to antibiotics. Sometimes, I mean, that's what they do often. And the antibiotics, high percentage of cases, do not eradicate the chronic infection of the prostate or inflammation of the prostate. Could it be that deep-seated infection that's hard to get at is part of the problem, and could serratia peptidase
absolutely
help the antibiotics or the botanicals penetrate further into the prostate?
It definitely has the potential to do that, and over the years I've had the occasion to make that recommendation, and clinicians tell me it's been successful for their patients.
Well, that would be a real breakthrough. So I think I'm going to order a boxcar load of some of those products. All right. And obviously, you know, other conditions that are less obviously infections, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome. One problem, very difficult to treat. It is thought by some that Lyme disease has a biofilm component because we know it's an infection, but it is hard to eradicate. Could it be that the spirochetes causing Lyme disease can hide and sequester themselves in a protective coating of biofilm?
There is evidence that that they do make biofilm. I'm sure you're familiar with Eve Safi's work, where she's demonstrated Borrelia biofilm. And so again, this is a situation where I would recommend the Serratia peptidase in conjunction with other with antimicrobial therapies, because it's well absorbed into the system.
Okay. Well, this is a fascinating introduction to the world of biofilms, and you've explained it quite well. What's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? Where can listeners or perhaps clinicians who are listening to this podcast get more information about biofilms and or products that can address the biofilm problem?
Well, if I may just invite people to contact me directly, my email is Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, at Prothera Inc. Prothera Inc. And okay. And I'd be happy to respond to requests for information.
Okay, so let's repeat that. It's Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, at, because otherwise it'd be with an A, it would be Stephen. It's Stephen at Prothera, that's P-R-O-T-H-E-A-E-R-A, Inc., one word, .com. ProTheraInc.com.
Right, P-R-O-T-H-E-R-A-I-N-C.com.
Right, and the actually there's and the subdivision of ProThera that makes this is called Claire Labs, and they're a great company. I worked with Claire for decades, and they continue the tradition. Originally named for a gal named Claire, the late Claire.
Claire Farr.
Who is very, very dedicated to treating highly sensitive patients with complex medical problems, offering real high-quality products. And, fortunately, Claire did not become defunct with her passing. With the brain trust consisting of you and others, it continues with the tradition of helping patients with complex, challenging medical issues. So congratulations on this, great work.
Right.
And we'll get the word out. And one other thing I want to remind you, if you would be so kind, if you can get that Candida questionnaire, if it's located somewhere on the Internet, we'll also provide our listeners with a link.
Okay, very good.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stephen Olmsted. It's nice visiting with you once again, and all the best. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.